This is March 12th, 2023, 1710 hours. My name is Ward Green. My voice gets a little bit funny. I think it's not the dairy now. I think it's the sugar. Sugar does that with my voice, with my vocal cords. It makes it a bit squeaky. And I just ate some peanut butter and quite a lot of marmalade. I'm going to have to watch the sugar, though. This marmalade is very low in sugar. It's not very sweet. But it's very important to not eat too much sugar. However, I'm an exception right now because I was poisoned with vitamin D, and I'm trying to do everything I can to prevent excess vitamin, content in my body. I'm trying to eliminate the effectiveness of the vitamins in my body, at least more so the vitamins which are toxic, like the vitamin D. I'm just feeling like it works better when I do attempt to take some steps in that regard, to eat more of things that I normally would not want to eat, like the caffeine in matcha tea is one example, but the sugar, and I mentioned chocolate. I'm not really eating a lot of that, but that's another one that could help suppress the uptake of vitamin D, and I'm not eating vitamin D, or it could help suppress the, without knowing much about how the human body works, we do know that with regard to how the body absorbs vitamins from the intestinal, gastrointestinal, or GI tract, certain things inhibit the uptake and absorption of those things, of those vitamins, and those things include sugar, caffeine. But I wouldn't drink coffee because I think it's very bad for the health. But matcha tea has caffeine, it's very safe. But also chocolate is another one that helps suppress these things. But the other thing is to eliminate D3 from the body. And that can be achieved by taking no vitamin D3 in the form of D3. But eating peanut butter, which gives also a form of D, which is called vitamin D2, and that is less effective in the body, so that should help to minimize the negative effects of vitamin D while still enabling. I mean, I don't feel any ill effects when I eat peanut butter, so, and that's supposedly where I'm getting the D2. Whereas if I take D3 like I did yesterday, I had a bad but minor reaction to it. When I took 1,000 units, I got slightly nauseous. Anyway, nauseous, which is not good. So it would suppress, it's terrible. It's a bad symptom. It means I'm still poisoned. I have to wait 15 or 30 days before I even consider D3 as a supplement. But I can eat peanut butter and I'm loving it. I feel great. So I fully recovered from yesterday's nausea. I mean, I have a great appetite. Especially before I took that thousand units of vitamin D, I had a great appetite. I didn't just need to eat calcium anymore. I could eat other things. I could eat fish and corn, and my appetite was changing. And I believe for the better, but I'll still need to take high daily amounts of calcium. I mean, in small dosages during the day, after this crisis is averted, that is. But I can still take calcium in significant amounts every day. Just I'm watching very carefully to make sure that the calcium is not causing any symptoms. So that's the health update. Today's study for all of us little children is in the Wild Road article. It's paragraph 3:9, and in the Bible it is Haggai chapter 2 and Genesis chapter 12, which we will consider from the standpoint of the Septuagint, which is not much different at all from the Masoretic text as far as Genesis 12 goes. We're not looking at Haggai from the Septuagint, but maybe we should be. I haven't prepared that, but this article, Wild Road Ahead to History, Part 1, Chapter 3, Paragraph 9, 3 plus 9 is 12, and it's March 12th, 2023, 17, 16 hours. Shall we begin? Akhenaten's vintage, year 17, would be dated from year 1 grape harvest in 1375, for year 1, that is, to, in brackets, 1375 minus 16, or year 17. After 16 full years begins year 17, and that would be 1359, which is 1375 minus 16. Or when 1376 be instead year 1, instead of 1375, then year 17 is 1360. However, with the year 16 lunar day minus 1 slash 1, October 11th, 1360, his highest attested date, meaning the highest year number. Akhenaten's year 17 appears to be 1359 based on that. Because this is a lunar day 1 or the day before, which means it's a very good alignment in October 11, 1360, that suggests his year 17 was the next year because that was the year 16 date. For, by skillful direction you shall carry on your war, and in the multitude of counselors there is salvation. Not knowing when a pharaoh lived, nor when one died, a date for any wine of this king is at least as obscure. Akhenaten's year 17 wine offers the time of his death. And since the evidence from Miller, 2007, is for an autumn death, it would be 1359 or 1358 before wine bottling. Hornung would order 17 successive vintages for Amarna, including year 4 wine vintage consumed at the site. Years 5 through 17 of Akhenaten made there, and the three vintages attributed to Akhenaten's successors there. Before we get to Tutankhamun, there are three vintages for wine at Amarna, according to Ancient Egyptian Chronology, page 208. The last, a year 3, having only three wine jar labels extant, likely not a full year. With Tut in 1357 and Akhenaten dying in 1359, there's no time for even two vintages in between them, and not three, certainly, so that these three must be in co-regency. It seems possible that Tutankhamun reigned in his year one under co-regency with Nefertiti because of his youth. So both his year one and her year three had been coexisting. Under passion reckoning, 1359 was year one. Although year one wine could not be until autumn 1358 for Smenkhkari. Now, this gets very complex here, but I'm hoping to explain this. I understand it, but I'm hoping to assist everyone who has not studied this to understand this. See, the Passion Reckoning of 1359, that would mean that Akhenaten died in 1359 is what we're saying. So if that's true that he died in 1359, which is what we believe, then the Passion, or March, in other words, the month of March in that year, was the year in which he died. That was the beginning of the Passion reckoning. But the year beginning in March was the beginning of the year by the Passion reckoning. So if he died in the autumn, then that was still the year of that year. That was the year one for the next king also by that Passion reckoning, starting in 1359. So so 1359 would be year one, not 1358. But the wine wouldn't come until the next autumn, after Akhenaten died in the autumn of 1359. So that's what that means. The first year of wine would be 13, or the first vintage would be in still in the year one that began in March of 1359. It began in March of 1359, but it was ongoing. No, it would. That's wrong. It would become the next year in March of 1358, right? Let me see. That's right. Well, no, the problem is, yeah, the problem is Akhenaten had the wine for the year 1359. It was his wine labels in the year 1359 is what we've been assuming. So therefore, in that case, the next year was the wine belonging to the next king after the death of Akhenaten, and that would be autumn 1358, possibly Smenkhkari. That's what we're saying here. And then, because not a lot is known of this or about this, so I mean, it's 1359 when Akhenaten died. Okay, so the next year would be the first year of wine for the next pharaoh. So there's a bit of a problem there. And thus, 1356, also I'm saying, next after that, we are reading this now, and this is what we're saying. 1356 does appear to be year three wine, because you can have 1358, 1357, and then 1356. And that year three synchronized with year three wine of Tut in 1357. Sorry, with year three wine of Tut in 1356. Also in the same year, 1356. Year three wine of Tut. Why is that a problem? Well, because we think Tut began to rule in 1357. That's the problem. He wouldn't have had time to get to year three. But a problem which could only have been resolved by Tut overthrowing the Amarna system and backdating his year one to 1357. That would mean that Tut's year wine, the Tut's year three wine, I mean, would not be in 1356 in that case, obviously. Unless, of course, he'd been co-ruling. He could have been co-ruling with somebody and then eventually backdated his rule to 1357. There's so many complexities and things we don't know. But I've tried to consider the most exact path, you know, the most logical and the simplest path of reasoning in this paragraph that can explain all of the possible the events, you know, all of the possible scenarios which are actually fairly reasonable or probable. I'm not interested in the unlikely ones too much, but we have to, but it also has to allow for those too. It has to allow for the unlikely possibilities too. So that's what we're trying to do in a very few words here. So if Tut had overthrown the Amarna system and backdated his year 1 to 1357, perhaps, or probably, it was the same time that his father, Smenkhkari, died. In February 1357. Approximately February of that year. Now the year 4 date, which is June for the year 4 date of Tutankhamun, that date for Tutankhamun can only be year 4 with an accession before June 24th, 1357, it appears. And that year 4 date was a lunar aligned date. That's why we know what date it is, you know, the June 24th. It's a lunar aligned date. We're mentioning that just in what follows here. It appears so that autumn 1357 wine vintage must belong to a year one. If 1354 is year four, then and if Tut began to rule in approximately February of 1357, then year four is 3 years and some months later, which would be June 1354, June 24th. 1354 is 3 years and some months after February 1357 BCE. So that, see, the autumn 1357 wine vintage is the first year of Tut. That's his first wine vintage in this assumed scenario when we have Tut becoming pharaoh in February approximately of 1357. The fall of that year is his year one vintage, and this is assuming an exact lunar day 15 for a June 24th 1354 date. So the year four date was this June 24th date of Tut, which is an Egyptian date, but it was converted into a Julian date. In the year 1354, it's actually June 24th. It varies depending on what year you pick. If it's in 1354 and that's his year 4, if that's correct, then it's June 24th. And it's also a lunar day 15, which is an exact Egyptian full moon in the Egyptian religious system. The evidence from Amarna wine labels and from the tomb of Tut is consistent with it being Tut's year 3, when a coup of import by Tut restored Amun worship at Thebes. So he returned to Thebes in his year 3 is what the evidence is consistent with based on the Amarna wine labels in the tomb of Tut, because there is no year 3 in the tomb of Tut in his wine labels. So it's evidence consistent, or it's the absence of evidence, doesn't prove much, but it's consistent with it, with Tut returning to Thebes in year 4 and not in year 3. Or right, it depends when in the year, and all the specifics it are important too. The three Amarna vintages are by King Ankh Khepruri. With year 1 and 2 of wine explicit, the year 3 implied by a single delivery of olive oil containing years 2 and 3. So the year 3 is merely implied for the Amarna vintages, which are three separate years, but only two of them are explicit. In Tut's tomb at Thebes are wine labels years 4 and 5. There we have it. So we don't have year 3 in Tut's tomb at Thebes. There thus appears to be reason to believe that year 3 of Tut was when Nefertiti died 3 years after the death of Akhenaten. In other words, perhaps Tut was co-ruling with her? It seems to be what I'm saying here, but I'm not saying it explicitly, so I might be just implying it. Which gave her a year three, that is Nefertiti, a year three attested in 1357, with Akhenaten's death in the fall of 1359. All these dates are BCE, before the Common Era. And her year two, or Smenkhari's, beginning in 1358. So this is because Akhenaten died in the fall, and it was by the passion system of years, you know, that where the year began in the month Passion, so that it was celebrating the sun. It was still the same year of the sun, beginning in March, after Akhenaten died in the fall. That was still that same year. That was year one of Nefertiti, is what is being said here, up until the next March, which is in 1358. And her year two would begin in March of 1358 and would end in 1357. March, which would also be true of Smenkhari if he were the one succeeding Akhenaten. But if Nefertiti took power in 1357 after Smenkhari's death in early February, it's a different scenario. Her year three would be 1356 to 1355 for Passion One Reckoning, because he died in early February, so that her first year would still be from February to March. Then her, of that year, 1357, then her year two would be from March 1357 to March 1356, and her year three would be from 1356 to 1355 for the Passion One year reckoning. March is the Passion One time, roughly. It's sometime in March or late March. Year two would be beginning then in March 1357, as I just said. It appears improbable that her year three could be the lunar day one, which is the inscription in the tomb of Peri, which we talked about before. It's third Akhet 10, which is called Hathor. That month is called Hathor, and it's the 10th day of that month. This inscription in the tomb, which it actually falls on lunar day one, but it's improbable that that would be her year three in October 1354, because of what we just said about her year three being 1356 to 1355. This is October, which is late in 1354. Tut's year four, full moon, lunar day 15, date, June 24th, 1354, which we've already mentioned. It's a very good alignment. In year four, we've got this full moon, a religious full moon, for in his year four, which seems to rebut the year three date of Nefertiti. If that date for her, if her year three were October 1354, because that's after this year four of Tut. So how could Nefertiti? It seems to rebut it, unless she's still ruling during the reign of Tut. So that alignment, which is so perfect, which is a lunar day one, is that in the tomb of Peri? Wait a minute. Yeah, it is. But you see, graffitos in tombs are not normally lunar day one. They're normally full moons. So that wouldn't be necessary anyway. Let me just do a quick check on the tomb of Peri. This is paragraph 39, but let's just do a quick check on Peri. See what we see. Right. It's the third Akhet, or Hathor 10, date. It's an exact new moon, but it's a graffito. So it's not typical that they would be a new moon. That's just not typical. Maybe it is possible, but and anything to do with the moon that's religious, we would think it were possibly, you know, correct, or could be possible. If it's got to do with the Egyptians, because they were very religious, but it was more typical. The Egyptians, when they were making graffitos in tombs, they were concerned with the afterlife, and the afterlife would be the full moon, because it was something to do with the life reaching fullness, right? Which it wouldn't do if it was just beginning. So it was something. It was, to them, it was more of a full moon event, as I understand it. That's the way I understand it. Based on the other observed tomb inscriptions. So, and it was in the tomb of Peri, but it would be because Peri had died, not because Nefertiti had died, but it was in his tomb, and it had to do with whichever king was ruling. It was the third year of that king. So, and it could be Nefertiti. But it wasn't necessarily in the year 1354. Okay, but also owing to well-aligned lunar dates in Tut's reign. All of Tut's reign has good lunar alignment, and that's why it doesn't look like Nefertiti was ruling at this time in 1354. Unless they were co-ruling, but there's no evidence for that, because this is year 4 of Tut. He'd already moved back to Thebes. Amarna was gone already. So it doesn't seem possible that... See, Amarna... Tut closed down Amarna and he moved back to Thebes. This is his year 4 and it's at Thebes. He's not... Nor is anyone else at Amarna. That's why this seems unlikely, that 1354 could be in the tomb of Peri at Amarna in the year 1354. It's more likely a different date before that, also because of the lunar alignment, which is not near the full moon. Okay, so the year 4 date of Tut is a graffito from Saqqara near Memphis. So that year 4 date for Tut is actually from Saqqara near Memphis, which is further north than Thebes. Okay, it's a graffito. So all the Egyptians celebrated their pharaohs, and they made inscriptions on monuments or in the tombs. But this is a graffito. So it seems good as a lunar day 15 also, for the fact that it's a graffito. It doesn't say it's in a tomb on this particular occasion, but it says it was for Shemu, or the month of Misori. The day 2 is the date. It's a lunar day 15, as we said, in 1354. And Lunar Day 15 is a typical religious occasion for such a graffito. So I suppose it is something to do with the death of somebody. But we can't cover everything on every occasion here. We'd have to research that graffito. If anyone's interested, then they research that particular graffito from Saqqara. They find out about it. Which I've already done it, but I couldn't record every single fact here. I've recorded it as faithfully as I possibly could, as far as I'm aware. And there is an improbability about Nefertiti's having her accession in February 1357, with October 1354 being only year 3, as we said also. Right, and that year would have belonged to, if she exceeded in 1357, we said it would be February until March would be the rest of that year for her, and then it would be her next year from 1357, from March of 1357, would be her year 2 until 1356, and then her year 3 would be 1356 to 1355. So it doesn't include 1354 in her year 3. That's why it's improbable also. So all those things were summed up in that paragraph, but It was very information dense, as we saw. Maybe I can just tip this slightly to get my head slightly better centered here. Better, I think. Yeah. Okay. So in the notes here, the year three, in footnote four, it says the year three was implied by a single delivery of olive oil. Well, that year three is not explicit, however. And a year one vintage on page 207 of Ancient Egyptian Chronology, page 207, the last paragraph, a year one vintage following these years one and two is actually the last known vintage. And the other notes are mentioning the article, the proverb, chapter 24, verse 6, the New World Translation, reference version from 1984. The footnote 2 is Jared Miller's article about the identity, the same article we've been referring to, about the identity of Nibiruria in the light of a newly reconstructed Hittite text, according to what Jared Miller reported in 2007. And footnote 3, the chronology in the present article with its lunar alignments does not permit the successors of Akhenaten to rule for 3 years after Akhenaten. That was footnote 3. That was a footnote applying to this sentence here. The three vintages attributed to Akhenaten's successors at Amarna were not three full years, is what is explained in that footnote. So that's it for that study for today. Now let's look at Psalms, if we may. Or not Psalms. We're not. No, it's not Psalms we're looking at. We can look at Psalms, but it's not in our study today. It's Genesis, but also I want to look at Haggai. So I think we're going to look at Haggai. I didn't prepare Psalms, so that's why we're not looking at it. I'm looking at Haggai right here. Chapter 2, we've done Haggai chapter 1, but we never got a chance to do chapter 2 for some reason. Perhaps I forgot to do it. And now it fits because it's March 12th and the last digit of the number 12 is 2, so we're going to do Haggai chapter 2. And Haggai chapter 2, it reads, in the seventh month, on the 21st day of the month, the word of Jehovah occurred by means of Haggai the prophet, saying, say, please, to Zerubbabel the son of Shealtiel, the governor of Judah, and to Joshua the son of Jehozadak, the high priest, and to the remaining ones of the people, saying, who is there among you that is remaining over, who saw this house in its former glory? And how are you people seeing it now? Is it not, in comparison with that, as nothing in your eyes? But now be strong, O Zerubbabel, is the utterance of Jehovah. And be strong, O Joshua, the son of Jehozadak, the high priest. And be strong, all you people of the land, is the utterance of Jehovah. And work! For I am with you, people, is the utterance of Jehovah of armies. Remember the thing that I concluded with you, people, when you came forth from Egypt, and when my spirit was standing in among you. Do not be afraid. For this is what Jehovah of armies has said. Yet once, it is a little while, and I am rocking the heavens and the earth and the sea and the dry ground. And I will rock the nation. I will rock all the nations. Or I will rock the nations, but I will rock all the nations, and the desirable things of all the nations must come in. And I will fill this house with glory, Jehovah of armies has said. The silver is mine and the gold is mine, is the utterance of Jehovah of armies. Greater will the glory of this later house become than that of the former, Jehovah of armies has said. And in this place I shall give peace is the utterance of Jehovah of armies. In the 24th day of the ninth month in the second year of Darius, the word of Jehovah occurred to Haggai, the prophet. Saying, this is what Jehovah of armies has said. Ask, please, the priests as to the law. Saying, if a man carries holy flesh in the skirt of his garment, and he actually touches with his skirt bread or stew or wine or oil or any sort of food, will it become holy? And the priests proceeded to answer and say, no! And Haggai went on to say, if someone unclean by a deceased soul touches any of these things, will it become unclean? In turn, the priests answered and said, it will become unclean. Accordingly, Haggai answered and said, that is how this people is, and that is how this nation is before me, is the utterance of Jehovah. And that is how all the work of their hands is, and whatever they present there. It is unclean. But now, please, set your heart on this from this day and forward, before there was the placing of a stone upon a stone in the temple of Jehovah. For when those things happened to be, one came to a heap of 20 measures, and it proved to be 10. One came to the press vat, I need some lip balm here. One came to the press vat to draw off 50 measures of the wine trough, and it proved to be 20. I struck you people with scorching and with mildew and with hail, even all the work of your hands, and there was no one with you turning to me, is the utterance of Jehovah. Set your heart, please, on this from this day and forward, from the 24th day of the ninth month, from the day that the foundation of the temple of Jehovah was laid. Set your heart on this. Is there as yet the seed in the grain pit? And as yet the vine and the fig tree and the pomegranate tree and the olive tree, it has not borne, has it? From this day I shall bestow blessing. And the word of Jehovah proceeded to occur a second time to Haggai on the 24th day of the month, saying, say to Zerubbabel, the governor of Judah, I am rocking the heavens and the earth, and I shall certainly overthrow the throne of kingdoms and annihilate the strength of the kingdoms of the nations. And I will overthrow the chariot and its riders, and the horses and their riders will certainly come down, each one by the sword of his brother. In that day is the utterance of Jehovah of armies. I shall take you, O Zerubbabel, the son of Shealtiel, my servant, is the utterance of Jehovah. And I shall certainly set you as a seal ring, because you are the one whom I have chosen, is the utterance of Jehovah of armies. That's the end of Haggai chapter 2. Notice in verse 22, the strength of the kingdoms of the nations will come down, each one by the sword of his brother. They will kill each other by the sword. That is an incredible, amazing, wonderful prophecy of Jehovah that shows that the word of Jehovah is what causes these people to die, but it doesn't happen that by Jehovah's direct intervention? No. He intervenes in a way that causes them to kill each other. Interesting. And truth. It's full of truth. It's true. It's what's a word for that? Truth. Establishing truth, truth giving, I guess you could say. It's truth rich, with it's a sacred secret, right? The Bible, a lot of it, and essentially all of it, is a sacred secret. It's not to be revealed to just anybody, or to not to be understood by just anybody. It's a sacred secret. The interesting other thing I wanted to mention here, the other thing that strikes me, is that the ninth month, the 24th day, this is still the second year of Darius. And when the temple was founded, it says in verse 18, the 24th day of the ninth month, the day that the foundation of the temple of Jehovah was laid. Remember that, Haggai 2 and 18. And remember Haggai 2 and 10, the 24th day of the ninth month, when Haggai spoke as inspired by Jehovah about the law and how uncleanness affects things adversely, but holiness does not cause what is unclean to become holy. And verse 18 shows that the foundation of the temple of Jehovah, this second temple, because Solomon's temple was the first temple, which was destroyed in 587 BCE, but this is the second temple, and it occurred in the second year of Darius, as consistent with verses 18 and verse 10. The 24th day of the ninth month, foundation was laid. Verse 10, the 24th day of the ninth month, in the second year of Darius. This is Darius the Mede, and that means his first year, of course, would have been 539. Well, we know it well from historical evidence that 539 was the year that Babylon was destroyed by the Medes and Persians, and Darius with Cyrus took the power at Babylon and began to rule. The second year of Darius, therefore, is, if depending on how we account the years, but let's account it as the year of the, let's say, which year it is in the Jewish system, because the Jews are at Jerusalem building, so they're going to count things from their calendar, which is Nisan, the first month. So the ninth month would be something like December or November, December of the year 538. If the first year, wait a minute, the first year of Darius was beginning around October when Babylon was conquered by the Medes and Persians. That's late in the year 539, but that falls within the Jewish religious year of, you know, the Nisan to Nisan, spring to spring year. That's 539 March or April until, or something roughly approximating spring. Spring of 539 to spring of 538, that would be year one. And then year two would be 538, spring of 538. To spring of 537, so year two. So these things could have happened very easily in the ninth month, late in the year 538, which is still in year two of Darius in 538, after the fall of Babylon in late 539. So it's very consistent with the 538 date for these events in the Julian calendar, 538, which, that's good because that's 70 years after 608, which is the time when the official year one of Jehoiakim might be considered to have begun, although that's not necessarily the way it would be calculated, because the Jews were not in power really at that time, because Jehoiakim was a vassal king under the Egyptians. So whether, and he probably took the throne, I should say, from the Egyptians giving it to him at Jerusalem. They gave Jehoiakim the throne probably late in 609 BCE, because that's when Josiah was killed in July, August of that year. The best information that we've got is from the Babylonian Chronicles that give the Battle of Haran between the Assyrians and their Egyptian allies against the Babylonians from July of August to Elul, which is August, September of 609 BCE. On that basis, Josiah was killed in the month of Tammuz, or July-August 609. And then 3 months, Jehoahaz ruled after him, which would be from, let's say from July, it would be August, September, October, but if it was from August, it would be until November. And at that point, the Egyptians placed Jehoiakim on the throne in November of 539. So, based on that, we have the 70 years ending in 539 when Cyrus and Darius conquered Babylon. But here we have another date. Okay, so let's say that rule of that first year of Jehoiakim began in the fall of that year. But since he was ruling at Jerusalem, let's say that his official year began in the spring of the next year, which would be 608. If we were still using, you know, the official Jewish method, right? Which is hard to say whether we should or not, because the Egyptians were the overlords at that time. They appointed Jehoiakim. He wasn't really under Jehovah alone. I mean, I suppose Jehovah allowed this, but of course he did. So perhaps it should be reckoned from 609 or from 608, but if we reckon it from 608, then it's exactly 70 years until this fulfillment here, when the foundation is laid. And now, mind you, his first month of rule, if it began in the spring, would have been earlier than this, but it would be at least 70 years and more from 608 in the springtime until 538 in the fall, the late fall. So there's the 70-year fulfillment again of the prophecy of Jeremiah that said that the Jews would have to serve the nations, not just Nebuchadnezzar. They'd have to serve the nations. That's what the prophecy said. And Nebuchadnezzar was only one of those nations whom they served during those 70 years. But this is the fulfillment of the 70 years here. That's why Haggai 2 and 10 and 2 and 18 are so important. So that's it for Haggai. And now Genesis. I keep calling it Psalms, but it's Genesis. Chapter 12. I think we want to read it from the Septuagint just for something. Because most of us are well familiar with the Masoretic version. But this is the Septuagint version. So, I need to make it bigger, so I'll do that. Yeah, we'll do like we've been doing. And the Lord said to Abram, go forth from your country, and from your kindred, and from your father's house, to the land that I will show you. And I will make you into a great nation. And I will bless you, and make your name great, and you shall be one blessed. And I will bless those who bless you, and those who curse you I will curse. And in you all the tribes of the earth shall be blessed. And Abram went as the Lord had told him to, and Lot left with him. Now, Abram was 75 years of age when he departed from Haran. And Abram took his wife Sarah, and his brother's son Lot, and all their possessions that they had acquired, and every person whom they had acquired in Haran, and they departed to go to the land of Canaan. And they came to the land of Canaan. And Abram passed through the land. In its length, as far as the place Shechem, at the high oak. So that's the place called Shechem in the Masoretic text, but it's the big trees of Moreh, it's called in the Masoretic text. Or the high oak. Big trees, high oak. Now, at that time, the Canaanites used to inhabit the land, and the Lord appeared to Abram and said to him, to your offspring I will give this land, And Abram built there an altar to the Lord, who had appeared to him. And from there he withdrew to the mountain, to the east of Bethel, and set up his tent there, Bethel towards the sea, and Hagai to the east. And there he built an altar to the Lord, and called on the name of the Lord. And Abram set out, and as he traveled he encamped in the wilderness. And a famine occurred upon the land, and Abram went down to Egypt to reside there as an alien, for the famine prevailed upon the land. And it came about when Abram drew near to enter into Egypt, that Abram said to his wife Sarah, I do know that you are a woman beautiful in countenance. It will be therefore that, should the Egyptians see you, they will say, This is his wife, and they will kill me, but you they will keep for themselves. Say therefore, I am his sister, so that it may go well with me because of you, and my soul will live on your account. Of course, we know that Sarah was the half-sister of Abraham. We find out later Abraham's name was later changed from Abram to Abraham, and Sarah's name was changed from Sarah, or Sarai, to Sarah with two R's, or Sarah with an A-H at the end, depending on the different manuscripts. But Abram's name was changed to Abraham later on. But Sarah was actually his half-sister, we learn later. And say therefore, verse 13, I am his sister, so that it may go well with me because of you, and my soul will live on your account. And it came about when Abram entered into Egypt, as the Egyptians saw the woman, that she was very beautiful. And then the rulers of Pharaoh saw her, and praised her to Pharaoh, and brought her into Pharaoh's house. And for her sake, they dealt well with Abram. And he had sheep and calves and donkeys, male and female slaves, mules and camels. And God tried Pharaoh and his house with great and grievous trials because of Sarah, Abram's wife. Now, when Pharaoh had called Abram, he said, What is this you have done to me, that you did not tell me that she is your wife? Why did you say, She is my sister, and I took her to myself for a wife? And now, here is your wife before you. Take her. Hurry off. And Pharaoh commanded men concerning Abram to join in escorting him and his wife and all that he had, and Lot with him. And thus ends Genesis chapter 12 and also our study for the day. Thank you for joining me, little children. I hope you had a wonderful day so far. I hope you will feel gratified and blessed by the study of Jehovah's Word, the Word of God, the Holy Word, the Scriptures, the Bible, as they're also called. And the Word of God is, of course, also another title for the Son of God, the only begotten Son, Jesus Christ, who is the Messiah and the Anointed One, whom Jehovah chose to be the Christ of God, the one who would serve as the ransom, suffer for mankind, and deliver us, all of us, so that he is the only name that has been given under heaven by which we must get saved. That's an important scripture. People don't realize that the only way to be saved from the influence of Satan and the devil is to accept and believe upon the Lord Jesus, the Messiah. That's the only way. That's the only way. And if you are not willing to allow that, then you will continue to suffer under the influence of the devil, grievous things. And it's going to be grievous in some ways, no matter which you choose, there will be some grief, but there will also be great peace when we know Jesus and when we come to be his friend. There is great peace. There's peace among fellow believers, even though there's still going to be suffering in the world no matter which side you're on. And there's still going to be suffering by Satan's cohorts trying to adversely affect Jehovah's people. That suffering will not stop just because we become believers, but so many great blessings are realized when we are humble enough to accept Jesus Christ as our Lord and Savior. I know I was not one who immediately gravitated to that idea or to that faith. Not at all. No. It's just, you can try every other thing under the sun, even some things that may not be actually under the sun. You can try anything to avoid this, and many people do try to avoid the belief in Christ, myself having been included among them. But the peace that you gain by accepting Christ, you can only know what that is by accepting Christ, by being humble enough to accept that Christ is the one appointed and anointed by the true God, Jehovah. So this has been March 12th, 2023. It's 18:07 hours. Praise Jehovah. Have a wonderful day. I love you very much. Bye for now.